ladies and gentlemen. Welcome, wrestling fans worldwide, to Knoxville and the Great Smoky Mountains for the Ron Fuller Tennessee Studcast.
6 feet 9 inches tall, 265 pounds.
This historic podcast from one of the most respected and successful wrestlers and promoters will follow the footsteps of one of the largest and oldest wrestling families on the planet.
The Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller.
Through 93 years and four generations.
The Stud has arrived.
Old school or new fan, this unique broadcast will educate and captivate as Ron details decades of professional wrestling's growth with truly unforgettable stories.
I want those people out there at home to hear the Stud.
Sit back and enjoy the ride with the Tennessee Stud.
The Tennessee Stud. You will learn that name. You will remember it.
And now,
the Stud is here.
Please welcome the creator of the popular 605 podcast and the president of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network, your co-host, the great Ryan Last.
Hello again, friends, and welcome back to another edition of Ron Fuller's Studcast. I am the great Ryan Last, and it's my pleasure to be with you once again as the Tennessee Stud takes us up and down that road of wrestling history, sharing his personal tales and anecdotes and the misery of dealing with Big Jim Hess on a regular basis with you, the loyal listeners of the Studcast. Before we get going any further, let me introduce the host of the Studcast, the man of the hour, the Tennessee Stud himself, Ron Fuller. Ron, how are you today? Other than the Big Jim Hess problem, how are you today?
Hey, I'm doing great. I mean, we're giving that guy a whole lot of publicity, I tell you that.
I'll tell you.
But, yeah, I'm doing great, man. Absolutely fantastic. And really looking forward to today. This is a good one. I think fans are going to learn a lot of different stuff here.
Well, before we get to the show, and I certainly want to hear everywhere you're going to go this week, a couple of quick announcements. I want to thank everyone. Super Studcast number 17, part 1 and 2 with Jimmy Golden, getting rave reviews, and people have really, really enjoyed it. We enjoyed it. We enjoyed being a part of this show. And we want to encourage you to check that out, of course, patreon.com/studcast or tnstud.com. And we have a big announcement right now, actually. Super Studcast number 18, which will be released on Tuesday, June 11th, with Ron Garvin. This is going to be a major episode. This is going to be a big one. We're going to talk all about Ronnie's career as well as his time around Ron in Florida. And of course, in Knoxville. This will be a very memorable Super Studcast. Join now, tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast. And a big thank you to all the new patrons of the Studcast, as well as all the new listeners of the Studcast. The numbers keep going up, and we really appreciate everyone jumping on board and celebrating wrestling history with us each and every week. And on that topic, Ron, where are we going this week?
Well, we're going to cover the last two shows at Cherry Valley Park in April of 1975. And we're going to cover the TVs, both the television programs supporting those two shows. We're going to add two more matches to the third Coliseum show with the NWA title on the line. That's on Sunday, April 27th, 1975. And we're going to jump on a plane and fly across the state to Memphis for a very unusual 2 out of 3 world title shots in 14 days are going to happen in Memphis. And finally, we're going to get that all-important call back from the Knoxville, largest television station in Knoxville, with that appointment date to sit down with them and discuss the future of Southeastern Wrestling being potentially on their station. So we've got quite a bit on our plate today, and I'm just ready to roll when you are, my man.
Well, let's get rolling. You mentioned that we're going to talk about the two Knoxville shows leading into the big Coliseum show. Let's start there.
All right. So let's start with Friday night card on April 18th, 1975. We're in Chilhowie Park that night, and we'll discuss the TV show 6 days that's going to follow this event 6 days later. Actually, we'll discuss the TV show that leads up to this date. So the opening match for the April 18th card is Sam Bass versus Davoy Brunson. Then Ron Wright's brother, Don, against The Mummy. Jerry Bryant versus Tony Peters. Tojo Yamamoto and Jerry Jarrett versus the Australian, Johnny Gray and Tony Costello. And the main event is the first time ever for Knoxville wrestling card. For a Knoxville Southeastern wrestling card, that is, with a six-man tag. It's going to be Ron and Don Bass and myself, managed by Sam Bass, against Dale Lewis, Jimmy Golden, and Les Thatcher, and they're going to be managed by none other than Ron Wright. So that's the card for the 18th, and let's see, since that's the card, let's take a look at how I set it up on the TV to get the most pop for this card. By this point, I'm not taking any chances by giving my renegade commentator, a Big Jim, any opportunities to ruin the show, trying to be a star rather than just a commentator. I think that's what his biggest problem was, and I'm going to try to sit on top of him with these formats. And I'd recorded two matches from the April 11th card. That's one night before this TV is going to show. And what we recorded was the Tennessee tag match, where the new team of Ron and Don Wright won the championship from Nelson Royal and Les Thatcher. And we also recorded the main event between the former NWA champion Pat O'Connor and myself, in which the winner would be getting the title shot at the NWA World Champion Jack Briscoe in 16 days later at the Knoxville Coliseum. So since we started talking about Jim Hess, let's just jump right into old Jim, because we're talking about a television here. And so Big Jim's going to show up for the second time now, late again. And as soon as he sees the format, he started right away complaining about showing portions of two live matches from the night before, same as he had done the program before. He was a little bit enthusiastic to see Ron Wright back on the show, except he instantly complained about the fact that he was only on there as a manager and not wrestling. He also, again, disgustedly threw the TV format on the set desk to display to me his bad attitude before he walked off right before the program started. I tried to placate him. I called him back. I said, "Jim, come here a minute, man. I reminded him that Ron Wright could not wrestle yet. The reason he wasn't wrestling on the TV is because he was injured in the Texas Death Match at the second Coliseum show on March 28th. And then I tried even a little harder by being as polite as I could and explained to him that Ron Wright had probably had 500 matches on TV in Knoxville over the years and didn't need more exposure as a wrestler. And also that Wright was not wrestling on this card on that Friday night, the following Friday night. He's only managing. So, and then I even went a step further. I'm really trying to placate him here a little bit. I added to my explanation that, in my opinion, Ron's mouth was worth a lot more than his talent in the ring. And I probably wouldn't have said that exactly if Jim hadn't made me mad by questioning my judgment concerning how the show was pieced together. After all, I own this company, and if I failed and I failed at it, it wasn't going to hurt him. In fact, at this point, I was pretty sure he wanted me to fail. I'm getting the feeling that Big Jim doesn't want to do business with me, and he's not happy with the television show since John Kazana had left. And I'm also pretty sure he probably went straight to Ron Wright and told him how I'd insulted Ron by saying that, his mouth was better than his work in the ring. And, I think that would have created maybe potentially another problem between me and Ron Wright had he done that. But I just felt like when he walked away, that's probably where he was headed at that point. Just to make sure old Big Jim wasn't going to sink me this TV show with his apparent attitude, I went back and changed the order of the format and put myself on first watching the match that I had just had the night before against Pat O'Connor. And this way, I felt like I could take control of the opening segment and ensure at least that Big Jim wouldn't screw up the program from the very beginning, and it might be further into the program before he made some horrible mistake in one way or another.
And now, it was last week on the show where you said you had a Pat O'Connor promo that was sent in from St. Louis, and then coming out of that promo, Big Jim Hess talked about how old Pat O'Connor was, correct?
That's correct. And, oddly enough, he's going to do that again today. It just gives you and everybody out there the idea of how it was going. So, what I did is I opened the program. Like I said, I showed this film in which I won and beat Pat O'Connor. And And it was a great piece of film because it had a lot of beautiful wrestling moves and counter moves in it. But, you know, that we really had a tremendous match. Pat was so smooth as a wrestler in the ring. And I really didn't know how smooth he was until I was partners with him a couple of tag matches in 73 and 74 in St. Louis and got to see him in the ring actually doing his thing. So that night in Knoxville, he did exactly what he had promised me he was going to do on so many nights in St. Louis when I was helping him with finishes. And he told me, Ron, I'm going to come work for you if you ever get your own company and I'll put you over good. By golly, he comes to Knoxville and does exactly what he says. He put me over really strong, right in the middle of the ring. And afterward, I thanked him profusely for the match. And as I talked over the match with O'Connor, Big Jim, I had absolutely nothing to say, and I was pleased with that. That was great. I didn't want him to interrupt. I didn't want him to break my train of thought. I didn't want him to say something stupid while I'm sitting there. And he was just fine in that entire segment, except after I left the desk and before he went to commercial break and I'm walking away, I hear him say, you know, that would have probably been a better match if Pat O'Connor hadn't been so old. So, again, I wish O'Connor had been there to hear that. He said, oh, man, I wish Pat O'Connor had been here to hear you say that. So now 2 weeks in a row, he's insulted Pat O'Connor because of his age and just could not wait until he could get his little moment in there. And that's kind of what I've been dealing with as fans around the country and around the world. We get a lot of comments about Big Jim Hess, I'm just trying to remember all I can that he did that just made me really mad, made me upset, and it seemed like Pat O'Connor was a real target for him.
Not to play spoiler, Ron, but obviously you try to get on a bigger station. You do get on a bigger station. That gives you the ability to get away from Big Jim Hess, who worked at the station you were currently on. Did you ever think about what would have happened if that wouldn't have worked out? If you had not been able to get the bigger station and you were stuck with Big Jim Hess going forward, how would you have dealt with that?
I think I would not have been successful in Knoxville. I think it was that big a problem for me. I believe that he would have drugged me down. The television did not have the range to get out and create a territory from. I would have been a promoter of Knoxville. I may have had the opportunity to run a few matches for Jarrett in Johnson City in the Tri-City area, but to build a territory off of that small television station and with a commentator who was going to deal with business like Big Jim Hess did, I don't think I would have had a chance to be successful. It was that important to me to try to go to another television station. So let's jump to the next segment. Was a great tag match with the new Tennessee champions, Ron and Don Bass, so wrestling live on TV. And they're managed by Sam Bass. I don't know how familiar you are with Sam Bass. Sam Bass was a great talent. He didn't look like much. You wouldn't have thought he could wrestle at all. He could wrestle a little bit, but he was a much better talker and a much better manager. And then as soon as they had that tag match, they followed that with an interview. And so... we're going to be talking, you know, on this interview about six-man tag and the next event. And I'm going to join them for that interview for that six-man tag for the following Friday night. And in the last segment of this show, we have a live six-man tag with Dale Lewis, who's now a babyface, and partners up with Les Thatcher and Jimmy Golden. And it may have been one of the few six-man tags ever on TV there, and certainly the first since Southeastern started. I know that it was the first six-man tag I'd put on television as a match for Southeastern. The fans in the studio obviously loved it, and the TV ended with a bang as old Ron Wright returned, and he joined the three of those guys. He joined Lewis, Thatcher, and Golden out there at the set, and he's going to be managing them. And he rants and raves about his injury from me in the last Coliseum show and that he can only manage in this one because he's still not well yet, but he's getting real close. He's making a point of saying he's getting real close to being able to come back and get into the ring. So By the end of this program, I felt like I had dodged another bullet from my renegade commentator. And we did very well at the gate the next Friday night, considering that we're going to have three pretty weak opening matches on that card of the 25th of April, basically 2 days before the Coliseum show. But it wasn't all perfect. Before I left the TV station, Dale Lewis took me off to one of the offices located on the first floor, and he told me he decided to leave because he was afraid he was going to be sued by the guy who got hurt 3 weeks earlier in the Danny Hodge incident. I was just as concerned about that issue as he was, but I couldn't leave town, and he could. So he was the only wrestler. He was only a wrestler, and I am sadly at this point an owner that is having to deal with that horrible incident. And I knew when it happened, I was going to be ultimately totally responsible for what happened that night. I accepted my fate, and I also accepted Dale's notice at the same time. He wanted to go as soon as possible. He said in his own words, I believe, before they could serve him papers for the suit. And I told him that would be okay if he would work following Friday night, which he's already scheduled for, and the following TV on the next Saturday. And he agreed. And so now I had lost four top heels in 3 weeks, Dutch Mantell, Danny Hodge, Dale Lewis, and John Foley. Southeastern was going to go into its first May very short of quality heels. This was really going to try my ability as a booker, my first experience as a booker, because May's a difficult month. It's just before schools close. And usually business is going to pick up in June, but I'm thinking that, gosh, I may have to struggle through May here. But I'm going to be working hard at trying for that not to happen.
Dale Lewis had been built up for several months, and he just turned babyface. You never got to flesh out his babyface run because he was gone so quickly. How do you think it would have worked? Do you think the fans would have taken to him as a lead babyface?
I think somewhat they would have. It would have depended on who he was wrestling, obviously. I had a ton of heat at that point. And if he's wrestling against me, he's going to be great. If he's wrestling against a smaller type of heel, someone that doesn't look as formidable as I did at 6'9", he'd probably have some difficulty at getting over as a babyface. Dale didn't have a real babyface look to him. He had a big body. He had hair on his body quite a bit. And he just, it would have been hard to push him as a babyface, but I was in a position where I really, really needed to. And I had to after what happened. You know, Brian, bad things sometimes happen when you're a booker, and losing four top heels unexpectedly in a 3 week period of time, that's a great example of not just something bad. That could be a disaster for a young company. Speaking of disasters, I was in the middle of one. Right? That's what I'm talking about here. You know, as some people say, when the going gets tough, the tough get going. And I was determined to make the most of this bad situation. And I was lucky to have two more matches from Dale Lewis to take advantage of his being over, because as the booker, I had not beaten him but one time in 4 months. And you just kind of mentioned that. I really hadn't had an opportunity to get much out of his leaving. So I had a huge Coliseum show coming up and the opportunity to leverage his 4 months of wins to get myself over even better to face Jack Briscoe in that Coliseum. And I was basically trying my best to turn the proverbial sow's ear into a silk purse by making Dale's exit from Southeastern a huge plus instead of a big minus. So I put on my promoter's hat and a little bit of the booker hat, and I figured out exactly what I needed to do. And they was going to start on the very next Friday night with that Knoxville card from the 25th.
And now you would run, just to clear things up a little bit, Ron, you ran your regular Chill Howie Park show on the 18th, then you ran a week later on the 25th, and you bounced back just 2 days later in the Knoxville Coliseum, correct?
That's correct. That's, you know, and I'd never tried that before. That's actually five shows in 1 month. that's really pushing your town when you're just trying to get it off the ground. And it made it pretty darn difficult for that Sunday show. And it would have made it difficult for the Friday show of the 25th, the six-man tag show. It's because those two events are only 2 days apart. But one of them happens to be a Saturday, and it gives me that opportunity to really focus on the Coliseum show on Sunday afternoon. So let's talk real quickly about the April 18th card. This TV is kind of setting this up, and Sam Bass had a 15-minute draw with Devoy Brunson, and Don Wright beat the Mummy. Now, I'm not happy with the Mummy match. There's not much you can do with a guy that's dressed in a mummy outfit. I mean, you know, he can't get on the mat, and he can't wrestle, and he can't move fast, and he can't even hardly take a bump. So his entire body is taped from head to toe, and when you hit him, they throw talcum powder on him in the dressing room so that when you hit him, it would look like smoke coming off or whatever off of his tape. And to me, the gimmick was, it was ancient too, as ancient as a mummy is, and just not a good idea. I never used this mummy after this again, and I would probably not used him at all, except it hadn't been for Jerry Jarrett. Was using that gimmick in Memphis, and I was having to rely more heavily on Jerry for talent because of my recent loss of heels.
Hey, Ron, who was the Mummy for you? Because I had heard rumors that Ron Wright actually played the Mummy in Memphis for Jarrett. Obviously, years earlier, Benji Ramirez, I guess, was the one who really popularized the gimmick. But who was the Mummy for you?
I think it was, I don't remember, to be honest with you, Brian, exactly who the Mummy was there. I don't think it was Ron Wright for me, though. I don't believe Ron was there for that because he's not on that card of the 18th. He was on there the 25th as a manager. So I don't know exactly who it was. I think Jerry was using some other people as well. I don't think Ron was able to work and do that every night for him. I know that Ron might have gone over there and done some on his Mondays in Memphis for him, but Ron was still working every day in Kodak Company. So he was not really available to do an entire run or an entire week of those matches. So I don't remember who did it for me, but I also remember continuing that night of the 18th, Jerry Bryan beat Tony Peters, Tojo Yamamoto and Jerry Jarrett beat Johnny Gray and Tony Costello. And in the main event, Ron and Don Bass and I, managed by Sam, beat Dale Lewis, Les Thatcher, and Jimmy Golan, managed by Ron Wright. So, you know, we filmed this six-man tag, and I worked the first of two angles that night between Dale and I. Now, Dale had already talked to me, and he said, I'm going to be leaving. So I wanted to get something out of him on Friday night, and I worked an angle there that night, and we won the match. And after we won the match, we just continued fighting, me and Dale alone. Now, there's six other guys. It's a six-man tag, and we're two of the guys of the wrestlers, and there's two managers there. So there's six other guys there available that just kind of backed off and let me and Dale go at it. And then finally, they started trying to pull us apart, but wasn't able to do it. And we fought out onto the floor. We fought out into the crowd, and then we fought almost all the way up to the heel dressing room before I made it into the dressing room and it stopped. So we had that we had filmed, and I was going to be able to show that the next day on TV. And we would also have do the second angle live on TV the following day. So, you know, everything is pointed toward these TVs, point toward the next Friday night, and the next TV show had everything to promote the card for this 25th event. Now, the Friday night of the 25th is a totally different type of event. I've got this match, the six-man tag results, me and Dale fighting like crazy. We're going to work a show, an angle live on that program this Saturday, the 6 days before April 25th show. And like I already said, I'm really taking a chance. I'm running four Fridays and a Sunday in the same month. I don't know that any company's done that anywhere, especially one that's fairly new.
Well, you know, another thing you're doing, Ron, I'm looking at the newspaper clipping, and I want to thank a friend of the show, Tim Dills, who sent in all the newspaper clippings. But I think this would be the first time this year, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, you're running outdoors because it says Wrestling Under the Stars, rain or shine.
Yes. And that's what we're going to have to do every summer in that park. That's one of the reasons I didn't like being in Chilhowee Park, is because summertime you can't run in the indoor building because there's no air conditioning. It's too hot. But they've got a beautiful amphitheater there that will hold about 4,000 people. And we're going to go out in it, but you have the chance of rain. And if you have a rain at the wrong time of night, you'll lose the entire event. So it's going to be a headache. There's a potential for drawing bigger crowds because the building, the amphitheater is almost twice as large as the building that we're in on the indoors. So there's a good side to it, but if you get the rain, there's a disaster for you. You might lose the entire night. So it's a, you know, it's a chancy deal. This Chilhowee Park is not the ideal situation. There again, it pushes me more toward the Coliseum all the time because you don't have to worry about the weather in the Coliseum, and you do in the summertime with being in Chilhowee Park. So we're back to the TV, the first segment of this show that's before the April 25th show. And we got the film that I said we had not done with the six-man tag, in which they have to pull us apart and we fight to the dressing room. And then so I watched that. So I go and watch that segment first. Dale comes out and interrupts me at the set as this segment is running out to where we're fighting and we're about to get up to the dressing room. And he challenges me to a match live on TV. Now, that's a big challenge because I'd never wrestled ever on television in Knoxville at this point. And so, you know, and I made that clear when he made the challenge, said, I don't wrestle on TV. And he says, yeah, you know, I figured out the reason you don't wrestle on TV is because you don't want to lose on TV. You know, a lot of people be watching. And so we argued about that back and forth a little bit. And then he slaps me and he calls me a coward. So, you know, I turned to Big Jim and best I can remember and say, give me time to put my gear on, my wrestling gear on, and I'll wrestle this jerk right here on TV today. That's exactly what happens. We're only 8 days away from Jack Briscoe in the Coliseum. I go out there in the last match on that television show and beat Dale Lewis right in the middle of the ring. Only 8 days before Briscoe in the Coliseum. So this is about as much as I was going to be able to get out of Dale because of this short notice. I had the big encounter with him. I beat him actually in the six-man tag. We fought afterward, and then I get to beat him again on television.
Do you think, though, he would have been an effective babyface opponent for you, like for a long-term feud?
I think we could have done a feud. I believe me and Dale could have drawn money in a feud, but I don't think I had very many other baby faces that could have taken, or other heels that could have taken on Dale Lewis and had good matches with him and been able to draw money. I just didn't. I didn't have that many single heels. Dale was my good single heel, other than me, for a big portion of the time that I had been there. And I did not have anybody built already. And now I'm more short of heels than ever because of the situation. I could have put Danny Hodge potentially against Dale Lewis. There's a pretty good combination of heel and babyface. Dale would have been able to work some with Danny, and that might have been a good set of matches right there. But other than that, now I've lost Danny at this point, so I couldn't even make that happen. So, you know, so in the rest of this TV show, we're going to show a film of the champions, George Barnes and Bill Dundee, getting a great win from Memphis. These are the Southern Heavyweight Tag Champions, and they cut me an interview in Memphis about their coming to Knoxville on this next Friday night show to defend their Southern tag titles right there live in the building. So then on that same television program, we have three live television matches, tag matches, which is unbelievable. I don't know that that's ever been done in Knoxville up to this point. And I'm pretty sure that I never did it any time after that, have three tag matches on one television show. And all three of these tag matches contain teams that were in this upcoming one-night tournament. for the Friday night, there's a big tournament to see who's going to get to wrestle these Australians, the Southern Tag Team Champions. In that tournament is Jimmy Golden and Les Thatcher as a team, Ron and Don Bass, with manager Sam Bass, Al Green, and Australian Johnny Green. Those three teams are all on this television program. It's an absolutely loaded TV. They had to be one of the best of all time in Knoxville. And all I could do was hope that by some chance that some of the key people at this big television station down the road would happen to be watching this show. Because I wanted them, if they had watched this, I think it was going to give them an excellent idea of what I wanted to do in the future. So it was the kind of TV I dreamed of producing every Saturday in the future if I could get on this other program and the other station.
So, Ron, let's go to this card. I want you to cover it. This is the 25th of April in Chilhowie Park, outdoors. Even though it's April, you're outdoors. And once again, 2 days before your big event with the NWA champion in the Coliseum.
Yes. And this card I think it's a very good example of how I got some really decent results in spite of the recent loss of four heels. And at the same time, I added a great match to the third Coliseum show that's going to be taking place 2 days later, as you just mentioned. So on this Friday night card, it's really just a buildup for the Coliseum with and the way I pieced it together, it's a one-night four-team tag tournament in which Les Thatcher and Jimmy Golden is there as a team, Ron and Don Bass, managed by Sam Bass as a team, Tojo Yamamoto and Jerry Jarrett as a team, and Al Green and Johnny Gray. The winners of that four-team tournament are going to get a shot at the Southern Tag titles of the great Australian team with George Barnes and Bill Dundee in the Coliseum 2 days later. So that gave this card four matches from the tournament alone, because the first two round winners are going to wrestle each other for the opportunity to get the tag shot with the Australians. And the two losers are going to wrestle to each other. And then to really emphasize the match, the Southern Tag Team Championship match that's going to go into the Coliseum, the main event on that same card that night is the Southern Heavyweight Tag Champions themselves, Barnes and Dundee, in Southeastern for their very first time. They're going to defend their belts against Don Wright and Steve Kovacs. It's a loaded tag night is what it is, basically. All tag matches. I'm not even on this card. And there's quite a few other people that normally on these cards aren't on this card at all. But by having the winners of this tournament wrestle for the Southern Tag titles, that's going to add another match to the big Coliseum show. And also, the fans get a chance for their first time ever to see George Barnes and Bill Dundee, which is a fantastic team. Those two guys were really, really great together.
Ron, did you think at all about, at this time, bringing in Jerry Briscoe before the match? Because I know that's been done in the past. It's been done with Terry and Dory. But where you bring in the brother of the champion, and he loses to the top guy that's going to face the champion on the next show. Any thought to doing that?
Well, actually, I'm going to have Jerry Briscoe on this card, but on the Coliseum card. But he's going to be wrestling against my brother, against Rob. And Jerry Briscoe is in Georgia at this point, and he is the Georgia champion. So, you know, there's an opportunity for me to use the Georgia championship in the Coliseum show. But I don't bring anybody in to try to knock me out of this. I think that worked so well for the Funks. It was kind of like a Funk way of doing it when they were champions. You had to beat Terry when Junior was champion, and you had to beat Junior when Terry was champion.
Yeah.
You know, and it was kind of crazy, but it really kind of made sense in a way. It's like one brother trying to protect another, and then would have been the case with Jerry Briscoe and his brother Jack. But at this point, I did not do it. I'm just wanting to really highlight George Barnes and Bill Dundee being Southern Tag Champions, get them started and get them over in the city so that I can utilize them maybe some in the future if I'm not able to pick up the heels that I need to add to the territory. It was a really big night for us. The results of that night, it almost sold out. You know, we had a good good crowd out there in the outside, and the fans love the outside. I found that out too. It was my first opportunity to run a match out there in the amphitheater, and I really saw that fans enjoyed it. It was really a great venue, actually, Brian. Super. I mean, you had a big stage and a dressing room behind the stage that went all of, probably 200 feet across, and then the amphitheater was built up as a it had like a general mission type seating, except the with long rows of benches that just and huge. I mean, it was a really, really nice place. The stars, wrestling under the stars, big ring light that was held up over top of the ring for the stage. All the ringsiders were up on the stage. The rest of it was all general mission. It was a beautiful facility and a great place actually to work at night. So it was really something. And we really were set up good for this Coliseum show. And we filmed the finals. Like I already said, I think we filmed the finals of the Barnes and Dundee title defense. And we got an interview from them that we're going to use on the next morning's television to promote that Coliseum for 2 days later. And since we're already at that third Coliseum show, we're going to add a couple of matches. I said we'd do that in there. And obviously the main event's going to be me and the NWA World Heavyweight Championship match with Jack Briscoe. And then the semi-main event is now set after that Jimmy Golden and them have won this match, won this tournament. They're going to be in that big match for the Southern Tag Team Championship with Barnes and Dundee. I'm going to add another match to this card. I said I would do that in the opening here. And that's going to be somebody that's returning to action after being out more than a month. Ron Wright is going to be back in the ring live on this Sunday afternoon show in the Coliseum. And he's going to face a wrestler who would be making his first ever appearance in Knoxville. But this guy is going to go on to become legendary in Knoxville. That's going to be none other than the Mongolian Stomper. And he's going to be managed by the great black wrestler and manager Bearcat Wright. So we're going to dig deeper into this Coliseum show next week, obviously. But we're set in a good position here. I go out into that outside amphitheater not knowing what to expect. We get a pretty darn decent crowd there. I was thinking, they may be waiting to spend their money on the Coliseum, but I think I've got them going enough that they spent their money for the Friday night, and hopefully they're going to come back for that Coliseum show and see that world championship.
Well, we will come right back with more about this story, but first, a word about the latest Super Studcast as well as the next Super Studcast, Super Studcast number 17 with Jimmy Golden, and the next one, Super Studcast number 18 with Rugged Ronnie Garvin.
Jimmy Golden discusses much more than just his 50 unbelievable years in the ring on Super Studcast number 17 at tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast. This star circled the globe twice in his career, from Southeastern and Continental's gorgeous Jimmy Golden to WCW's Bunkhouse Buck. Golden and his cousin Ron Fuller, the Tennessee Stud, leave no stone unturned in their current hit, Super Studcast number 17. This true wrestling classic is told by members of the oldest and largest wrestling family in history, the Welches. Then get ready for Super Studcast number 18, part one of The Fist of Stone, Ronnie Garvin Spectacular, will be released on Tuesday, June 11th. Patrons are loving these Super Studcasts, and if you haven't listened, you're missing the hottest wrestling podcast out there at tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast. 3+ fantastic hours of old school wrestling for only $2.99 in every Super Studcast. Cast. Saddle up.
There you hear it. The Super Studcast available for patrons of the Studcast at tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast. For only $2.99, you can get in the door. It's the best deal in wrestling. And thank you to everyone who has jumped in at other tiers. $5, $15, $20. We really do appreciate it. And thank you for all the compliments and for everyone who's been checking out the Super Studcast. And once again, we'll tell you more about it at the end of the show, but number 18 will be with Ron Garvin, one of the biggest stars in the history of Knoxville wrestling and someone whose career intersected with the Tennessee Studs time and time again. But before we get there, Ron, let's return to this story. You said that you got four world title matches in just 3 months in early 1975. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, man. And this is so unusual. You know, I haven't had several, many world title matches. I never had so many title matches in such a short period of time. Four of them in early part of 1975. And all of them are obviously with Jack Briscoe. And, you know, I'd like to dig into Jack Briscoe's history a little bit, talk about some of his accomplishments, where he wrestled professionally, and you know, give fans just a little quick assessment of what type of wrestler I think Jack Briscoe really was. Jack Briscoe was born September 1st, 1941, in Seminole, Oklahoma. He was an American Indian and very proud of it. As well he should have been. He was one of the greatest amateur wrestlers of all time, and many people compare him to Danny Hodge and Vern Gagne in that respect, as an amateur. Fabulous, fantastic record at Oklahoma State. Big time performer there. Now he's going to start wrestling professionally. He'll be 6 feet and about 234 pounds when he turns pro in 1964, and he's going to be trained by one of the great wrestlers of all time, who is blind at this point, Leroy McGuirk. And, you know, some people say, how does a blind man train you in wrestling? But you know something? Wrestling isn't, it's a most unique sport. It's all touch. It's all feel. And what Leroy's going to teach him is a lot of stuff on the mat, obviously. But Leroy, you know, he can't do high spots, and he's not going to be able to teach him that type of stuff. But he is going to be able to take that tremendous amateur background of Jack and put those professional touches to it. And when Leroy finishes with him, Jack's going to spend the early part of his career, a lot of the early part of his career, wrestling in Texas in the early years. But he is going to spend a brief amount of time in my grandfather Roy's Tennessee territory. And when I first went to Tennessee, it didn't take long for Jack and I to sit down, and we talked about it. You know, I asked him, I wasn't aware that he'd ever worked there, and I asked him, did you ever work Tennessee? And he said, yeah, I did, Ron. And so I said, I probably shouldn't have said it or asked him any further, because, you know, a lot of guys didn't get treated very well in Tennessee, especially if you weren't liked by Nick. So I asked him, you know, well, how did you like it? And he had a great story. I never forgot the story. And what he told me is, he said, well, I'll tell you, Ron, he goes, I came out of Texas, and he goes, I was really very green and didn't know very much. He said, but I had a pretty decent car. You know, he said, I had a Cadillac. It was an old Cadillac, and I was really lucky. You know, I'd made a little money in Texas. And he said, I got to Nashville, and he said that they treated me horrible, Ron. He goes, they starved me to death. And I was really embarrassed, you know, and I was like, oh, were you spending a lot of time with Roy? No, I never dealt much with Roy, he said, but I dealt with Nick all the time. And I said, well, you know, by starving you to death, Jack, what do you really mean? You know, I thought he's exaggerating a little bit. And he says, well, I'll tell you, Ron, he said, it's probably pretty simple. He said, I drove into Nashville in a Cadillac and I left on a Greyhound. So I was like, oh, Jack, you know, oh, I felt so bad. Like, my goodness, man, I mean, you come in and you got a little money in your pocket and you leave a territory and you're flat broke. It's you have not been treated very well, but he found a home. He's lucky. In 1969, he goes to Florida, his first time there, and he finds himself a home there. And I think that he was the one wrestler in Florida wrestling history most responsible for fans' respect of wrestling, of real wrestling. I believe I give so much credit to Jack for that, because he did it every night. He knew he was so good with his wrestling ability that he made wrestling fans out of people that probably never really liked wrestling. And it was during this same time that I was spending a lot of hours with him training in the Snake Pit in 1970 when I arrived, in 1771. It's right there. Jack is a force in Florida. He is the man in Florida during this time frame. And he's coming into that Snake Pit himself during those years.
Ron, we talked about it weeks before. I mean, maybe even months ago, actually, now that I think about it. But what do you know about when Jack was getting set up to win the NWA World title?
Well, yeah, we talked about that some when we did some Australia programs. He held a lot of regional titles. Through his phenomenal career, obviously. And he was scheduled to win the NWA World title from Dory Funk Jr. In early 1973. But Jr. was questionably injured in an accident on his father's ranch, Dory Sr.'s ranch, just before the title shot. There was a great deal of controversy, and I think we've talked about it some, Brian. The controversy over this injury or the fact that he wasn't injured. And it was said by a lot of people that Dory Sr. just did not want Jr. to lose to a pure wrestler like Jack Briscoe because Jr. was. Terry's one style, Jr.'s a total opposite style. Jr. is the wrestler, Terry is the brawler. Dory Sr. just didn't want his son to lose to a better, pure wrestler than he was, Jack Briscoe. Honestly, and I give a lot of credit to Jr., Dory Jr., fantastic wrestler. But, had it been a shoot, it would have definitely been Jack Briscoe, too. And Jack was just a phenomenal wrestler. And I think it was in this same time frame that I was in Australia, early 73, and Jack was scheduled to come at the end of the tour in as world champion and defend his title. And there was some talk about that guy that would get that title match or a series of them, and probably would have been there for a week. I would have certainly gotten two or three of those title matches and maybe even more. Jack ended up taking over some of Junior's shots along with Terry when Junior supposedly hurt. And he even was sent to, Jack was sent there to Australia in 73. But before Jack arrives there, he's not champion when he comes. He just arrives. He's going to take the place of Junior at that point, who was supposed to be injured. And in March of 73, they send me back to Florida because Jack is having to move around and out of Florida shots to be able to fill holes where he can, so far as Junior was concerned. And one of those is that trip to Australia. So Jack is going to finally get that world championship belt on July 20th, 1973 in Houston. But he's not going to get it from Dory Funk Jr. He's going to get it from the man who beat Dory Funk Jr., and that was Harley Race. So Jack held that title until December of 1975. He only had one loss during that time frame, the Giant Baba in Japan. 4 days after he lost, he won the title back. And on December 10th, 1975, Jack lost to Terry Funk, the brother, obviously, of Dory Jr. And his world title reign ended forever. He was not a two-time champion or not so far as I'm aware of. I don't believe Jack ever won the championship after that. After his world champion days, he returned to Florida, and he worked in Puerto Rico. He continued to work in St. Louis, where he was a big star, and he got involved in Georgia heavily between 78 and 1980, in there quite a bit. And he and his brother, after those days, his brother, Gerald Briscoe, they're going to become stars of Mid-Atlantic. And he's finally going to end his career in the World Wrestling Federation of Vince McMahon in 84, 85. And he owned in his time frame in Tampa, during all of this, once he went there, he and his brothers, not just Gerald, he had a second brother named Bill, who I never got to meet, he spent 30 years there running a body shop called the Briscoe Brothers Body Shop. It was a famous place there for people to take their cars and get them fixed. And they did a fantastic job, obviously. And he runs that company along with his two brothers until he dies on February 1st, 2010, from complications during open heart surgery. Jack was a big smoker all his life. I remember that a lot in the early 70s. Chain smoked, and I suppose that had an effect on his heart, and he dies from a problem when he's getting open heart surgery done.
Ron, if you look back on your career, where do you rank Jack Briscoe amongst the wrestlers that you encountered during your active wrestling career?
Well, Jack Briscoe is, in my opinion, one of the best and maybe the best mat wrestler in the history of the sport. His amateur background gave him all the skills he is ever going to need to be a phenomenal wrestler. And the only thing that Jack lacked was the knowledge of shooting. And that was because you don't learn to shoot as an amateur. They don't teach you shooting moves. And if he had had the great shooting moves like he had the great amateur moves, he'd have been one of the most dangerous men on earth. You talk about UFCs and those type of things. Jack Briscoe would have been absolute terror in those type of matches. And because he never had the knowledge of how to shoot, that's why he spent a whole lot of time in the snake pit in the early 1970s, because the emphasis in the snake pit was on professional wrestling and not amateur. And he really got to learn the sugar hold and my dad's fuller leg lock and so many shooting type of holds. And for Studcast fans that may have never listened to the Snake Pit episodes, that's number 39 through 42. They can get them at tnstud.com. I highly recommend them because there's a whole lot of information in those four Studcasts that we did on the Snake Pit because Jack had such a integral part in that Snake Pit stuff.
So let's go back to my original question, Ron. You had four world title matches against Jack Briscoe in the beginning months of 1975. Let's talk about those matches.
Okay. So, we got four titles in 3 months, four shots. The first is in Louisville, Kentucky on January 21st, 1975. It's followed almost 3 months later with an unheard of, I don't know anybody that's ever done this before, seen this before, especially since it's in two different territories, with three world title matches in 14 days in two cities. I'm going to wrestle him in Memphis on April 14th, and 2 weeks later in Memphis again on April 28th. In between that, there's going to be one more title match, and that's going to be on this third Coliseum show on Sunday, April 27th. So I'm going to actually wrestle Jack on Sunday, April 27th, and then I'm going to fly to Memphis and wrestle him again on the next day, Sunday, April 28th. And two of those four title matches went 1 hour time limit draws, or broadways, as wrestlers refer to them. We call those hour time limits, any type of draw match, a broadway. And ironically, back in my early days in Florida, Jack and I were having a lot of these 1 hour broadways. And it kind of became a running joke between us because Louis Tillett was the booker back in those days. And he seemed like he would select either me or Jack at least once a week to do one of these hour broadways. So we got to where we were getting these every week, and we would get to a town at night. We would get our finishes, and then he would come to me or I would go to him and I'd say, "What are you doing tonight?" And if one of us had the Broadway, we got to where we would sing the little song, man, give my regards to Broadway and do a little shuffle, a little dance shuffle, right? Like I'm going through, I'm the lucky guy tonight. You know what I mean? It was a big joke between Jack and I, and we always had a big laugh out of that every week, because one or the other and sometimes both of us would do hours during the week. They liked broadways back in those days. Louis didn't like to figure finishes, I don't believe. He just didn't want to beat people, and it was easier for him to say, just go through. Wow. But believe me, when you're wrestling a guy like Jack Briscoe, going through is not an easy thing. Broadways with him, is no laughing matter, man. The Louisville, Kentucky and first Memphis title match were both 1 hour draws, like I said. And Jack was always in fantastic shape, had been that way all his life. He's one of those guys that had a natural body. I don't think he hit the weights ever in his life, but he still had a tremendous body. And his lungs were just, God, he could go forever. And staying up with Jack, you know, being in fantastic shape. And then when you become world champion, you just get better and you get stronger because you go longer and you're wrestling better talent. And it just makes you a even more a force when it comes to your cardio. And God, Jack was just at this point, his lungs were just stronger than ever. And staying up with Jack Briscoe was never easy. And at this time frame, he's really, really hard to stay up. And his style of wrestling, like I said, he was a tremendous mat wrestler. He did a lot of mat wrestling, and he did continuous up and down high spots, working either arms or legs. There weren't brawl-type matches. It wasn't a Terry Funk or a Harley Race type match. It's more a strict wrestling match. It's almost like a one-hour amateur match, it seems like sometimes. He did not want to be a big-time heel. He did whatever he had to do when he's wrestling a babyface to make them look good, but he didn't want to just throw a lot of punches and then get out there and brawl around. Now, in the case I'm the baby face in these matches, that's most unusual in itself that you have a heel that's wrestling for the title. That very seldom happens because most of the time the champion is a heel. But Jack is a baby face, always had been, always would be, looked the part, and so, you know, I'm going to have to go out there. And if you don't keep up with Jack Briscoe when he's doing his thing and he never slows up, if you can't get there to do his spot, he takes you down and he wallers you around and he makes you pay for it because you didn't get there. And you'll work your butt off to make sure you do the next time because you realize that I'm going to look like crap if I don't really get my ass in gear. He had no pity for people, for guys that couldn't hang. And he would really, really push the pace. So by the time we finished the last of the three matches in the 14 days toward the end of April, I was suddenly more happy with my decision to buy my own territory than to try to be world champion than I ever thought I would be. I realized that just how much effort it went into wearing that belt every night and to doing what you had to do in those matches to make it happen. And you had to make it happen every night because it was critical. It was critical for the sport. It was critical for the territories. It was critical for the wrestlers. You were the man, and you could not back down from that responsibility.
Ron, what about the matches in Memphis?
Both of them, first of all, both of them sold out completely. 11,300 fans, the maximum that they would allow in the Mid-South Coliseum. And had great matches with him. And I had suggested to Jerry Jarrett before when he wanted to do Louisville about raising the price. And then I suggested to him again. I knew we had these two title matches coming up. I said, why don't you raise your ticket price by $1? And for whatever reason, he didn't do it on the first title match. He said, yeah, Ron, I think I will, but he didn't do it. Now, the second title match, 2 weeks later, I suggested to him again, and I reminded him, and he remembered. He said, God, Ron, y'all had a tremendous Broadway match. It was fantastic. He goes, I believe I will try to raise those prices on this one just to see if it hurts the crowd. So he added that $1 for every ticket. And on that second time that we wrestled on the April 28th night of Monday, April 28th, 75, he broke the all-time box office record up to that time. On the week between, Robert and I came back and faced the Aussies in Memphis with 10,630 fans. We gave Jerry Jarrett 33,000 plus fans in three shows between the 14th or the 14th up to the 28th of April 1975. Wrestling was definitely on fire in Memphis. And, you know, I think we're probably running pretty long here. You know, to end the show today, I want to remind fans of the first meeting I had with that Top Dog television station in Knoxville, the biggest one there. And I'd been waiting very anxiously to hear if they were interested in having their own wrestling show. You know, either way, it would have had a great bearing on my commentator problem with Big Jim Hess. Whether I got it, whether I didn't, it's going to have some bearing on what am I going to do with Big Jim Hess. The call came from the sales manager that I'd met days earlier with the first time I went to that television, the new television station. And this was just the news I needed since my loss of four top heels unexpectedly. I needed something to boost my attitude a little bit. And the Lynn Lepper, who is the guy, the sales manager that I talked to, he says the station manager would like to meet me on Monday, April 28th. I got to fly that afternoon to Memphis to wrestle Jack Briscoe again. But I say, can we make it the morning? And he gets that set up for me. So I'm definitely going to be there for that appointment on Monday, April 28th. And that meeting is going to be one of the most important meetings of my entire life. I had a lot of work to do to get the proper presentation together real quickly. But if I pull this off and I get on this big television station, I'm going to erase any doubt about my future in Southeastern wrestling and in Knoxville.
Ron, we are tight on time, but one last thing just to tie everything together with the Danny Hodge, Dale Lewis situation. Whatever happened with the fan that was hurt? Did anyone get sued? What was the resolution when it came to the fan that was hurt during the $1,000 challenge in Knoxville?
Well, I'm going to, it's going to come back to haunt me. Let's just put it that way. Okay. I mean, he has not disappeared. He does not do anything early on. I don't know whether he's just trying to find himself a lawyer or whether he's thinking about it or whatever, but down the road here, before too long, I'm going to feel the repercussions of that night in which Hodge forces Dale Lewis to stomp this guy.
Well, as we wrap things up, we want to remind you that you can follow the Tennessee Stud on Facebook, the page Ron Fuller, the Tennessee Stud. You can also follow the Stud on Instagram and Twitter at Ron Fuller Welch. You can follow me on Twitter at Great Brian Last. You can hear me on the 605 Super Podcast at 605pod.com or available wherever it is that you find your favorite podcast. Also want to tell you, you can follow the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network on Twitter at Super Podcast, and the Studcast, as well as all Arcadian Vanguard shows, are now available on Spotify. For everyone that has been requesting that as a mechanism for listening to the shows, the Studcast is now on Spotify. Of course, the Super Studcast is always available at tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast. And number 17 continues to wow the fans as Jimmy Golden talks about 50 years in the ring. And you heard the announcement earlier. Super Studcast number 18 is coming at you part one with the man with the hands of stone, Ron Garvin, which will be released on Tuesday, June 11th. Get caught up on all the Studcasts before this debut on Tuesday, June 11th. tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast. Ron, where are we going next week?
Well, next week, Brian, I'm really looking forward to already. I mean, I got two huge events in my life that are both going to be highlighted in the next Studcast. One of them's going to be the breakdown of the entire third Coliseum show with my first title shot in Knoxville against Jack Briscoe. And the second huge event next week, we're going to try to duplicate the meeting that I had with the big Knoxville television station. As best I can, I'm going to try to recall how I prepared and presented my thoughts to the largest television station in the Knoxville market as to why I thought I was the man to make Southeastern Wrestling one of their biggest shows ever.
Ron Fuller's Studcast is a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. For the Tennessee Stud Ron Fuller, I'm the Great Brian Last. The story continues next week.
Thanks for joining us today for this historic Studcast. The true story continues next week. So fool Nelson your friends and point them in our direction for another ride with the Tennessee Stud.
One, two, three.
This is David Summers saying so long from the Great Smoky Mountains.